Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Show. It is Thursday, the 23rd of June, as we record. Coming up on the show today, DS Smith is our result of the week. Gemma Slingo calling in to talk through them. We've got Alex Newman talking about his big feature this week, lessons from VCs. And finally, we take a look at Ocado, Tesco, and other food retailers. Let's get into it. Welcome back to the show, listener. We've got Dan Jones hosting, Alex Newman, Mark Robinson, Gemma Slingo, and Madeline Taylor coming up in just a moment. But first, our roundup from the week that has been. More gloomy inflation figures this week. A fresh 40-year high for the UK. Figures for May's CPI at 9.1%. Sterling plunged on the news but has since somewhat recovered. Meanwhile, in the US, Fed Chair Jay Powell warned that a recession is, quote, certainly a possibility. Elsewhere, energy market regulator offset new policy proposals aimed at preventing a recurrence of supplier failures seen in recent months. Ofgem have recently been slammed by the National Audit Office, who said they allowed a market to develop that was vulnerable to large shocks. Airline cancellations show no sign of slowing down in the near future, with EasyJet most recently cancelling thousands of flights amid continued staff shortages. And on Monday, Heathrow Airport asked airlines to cancel 10% of their flights amid a baggage backlog. Ocado has raised £578 million to continue the expansion of the robotic grocery business. 72 million shares were offered at £7.95 per share, with buyers including institutional investors, capital, and Bailey Gifford. More on Ocado later in the show. Following the $1 billion-plus in fines levied by the US over corrupt practices, a UK court has convicted mining and trading giant Glencore of similar offences. The Serious Fraud Office said on Tuesday that Glencore, quote, had been convicted on all charges of bribery. The booming buy now, pay later business is to be subject to increased oversight from the UK Treasury. In a statement on Monday, the Treasury indicated plans to introduce rules forcing providers to carry out the same eligibility checks as other lenders and ensure the rates being levied on customers are affordable. A short trading update from gambling company 888 said that sales are broadly in line with board expectations and that it will enter into a new borrowing agreement to fund the acquisition of the non-US business of William Hill. And finally, Mike Ashley's Frasers has upped its stake in suiting giant Hugo Boss to 31% from around 25%, with the total holding now worth £770 million.
Thanks, John. Joining us today are Ideas editor Alex Newman, Companies editor Mark Robinson, and Companies writers Gemma Slingo and Maddie Taylor. We're going to talk a bit about Ocado and retail spending and discuss our cover feature on lessons to learn from high-growth investors. But we start this week in the exciting world of cardboard boxes, which have in fact become somewhat more exciting over the past few years. This is another sector at the epicentre of shifting macro trends. You've got tough comparators from recent years as some of those pandemic e-commerce tailwinds fade. You've got big increases in input costs and questions of how to pass those on. And now, of course, you've got a very uncertain consumer demand picture as well. Our result of the week is DS Smith. On that note, Gemma, you wrote up these results. You analysed the latest numbers from them. What's the sort of general feeling out there on from their point of view and from our point of view too?
I think they were surprisingly good, actually, sort of given the current macroeconomic backdrop. So shares in packaging companies haven't been doing very well since about the start of the year because, as you mentioned, they're so exposed to external pressures like energy costs and problems with raw materials, particularly something called recycled containerboard, which is basically the main ingredient in cardboard boxes. But contrary to expectations, DS Smith's actually done really well. So it said demand was still very strong and it managed to increase its pre-tax profits by 64%, which isn't bad going given a lot of the pressure it's under. And to give a scale of the challenges it's facing, input costs increased by £1.2 billion in 2022, which is quite hefty even for a big company. But it managed to offset that basically by increasing how many boxes it sold and sort of hiking up the prices of those it did sell. So yeah, quite a positive picture.
I think the thing that pleased some investors as well, in particular, you know, the outlook, you know, the guidance is what people are looking at right now. And as you say, it does still is still predicting 2-4% volume growth over the next year, which is seems pretty creditable. That question over e-commerce, there were some interesting things in the results about that sort of breakdown, perhaps, of where they're seeing growth and where they're seeing peaks as well.
Yeah, so e-commerce doesn't actually contribute a huge amount to DS Smith's revenue stream, because a lot of what it deals with is fast-moving consumer goods. But it did mention in its section about the UK that e-commerce isn't as strong as in the early stages of the pandemic. So presumably that's not going to have a great read across for the rest of the sector if online shopping starting to tail off. So I think in many ways that's where a lot of the money was coming from, in the sense that with e-commerce you can be more imaginative with the style of packaging you use and charge more for sort of clever uses of design to help transport maybe fragile objects. But that doesn't seem to be as strong as it was, say, this time last year. And again, if you're looking at online retailers and thinking what that means for them, it's probably not a really, really positive sign.
Yeah, I think it was, to me, it was notable as well that they're, you know, as you say, it's a relatively small part of their business proportionally to some others. But, you know, in Europe, actually, it was still holding up quite well and that growth was still continuing. Whereas for now, at least in the UK, it seems to have peaked. And maybe we're all a bit more getting back to the into the old swing of things over here. The US was a particularly strong sort of contributor as well, which I suppose you'd expect given the way their economy's been. Well, until quite recently, going pretty well. But I mean, what sense do we get of their kind of US plans, their US scope, and how that can contribute to the bottom line?
Yeah, so the US seems to be quite an exciting area for the company, and it is stressed quite heavily in its results how well it was doing. So it's got this new plant in Indiana, which seems to be driving a lot of the growth, and returns on sales is strongest in the US compared with its other markets. So seems to be a place to watch over the next few years.
The question now, you know, over here as well, is how much that kind of pent up demand. So I think they did say as well that, you know, it's actually labor shortages were one of the biggest impediments to even higher growth rates. But, you know, whether now they're getting that labor on board at just the time when that growth starts to peak a little bit. But that's not for us to forecast, I suppose. We'd all want to know the answer to that. Mark, Alex, do you have any particular thoughts on DS Smith? I know it's a company which can fly under the radar.
I don't have any particular thoughts on DS Smith, but just to the your point earlier, that we have seen demand for online commerce has trailed off slightly in the United Kingdom, but we should reiterate the point that was from a spike in the market as well. I think the direction of travel is well established, and I think, you know, volumes will gradually increase for the foreseeable future anyway. There's another aspect that you touched upon briefly as well, and that's linked to ESG considerations too. That's another area that packages are having to take on board going forward. It's not exactly you would imagine from their business perspective, the expansion of e-commerce is favorable over the long run, but it does entail some near-term capital investment as well, because as Gemma said, there's technological developments in packaging to reduce sort of the sort of damage in transit. That's one area as well, but they're also trying to reduce the amount of energy that goes into the production of specialist packaging, and also its wider effects on the environment, including water usage as well. So you imagine that packages themselves will be on the hook for increased capital cost in the year to come, or the years to come. But I think it's set fair in terms of that online demand.
It seems to have struck a decent balance between, you know, I think there is some more CapEx coming in next year and, you know, paying down debt at the same time and, you know, returning some money as well. So as you said, Gemma, a fairly creditable performance. How does that sort of compare with, you know, the peers, you know, Mondi, I suppose Smurfit Kappa as well, things like that? How do you see it sitting in that group?
I think Mondi is quite an interesting company to compare it to, because obviously it's another packaging giant, but it has not been having a good year at all because it's been very exposed to Russia. I think it's around an eighth of its revenue comes from Russia, but I'll double check that. And obviously, given the geopolitical situation, that's become sort of untenable, and it's now looking to divest its Russian assets. At the moment, it's quite hard to see what effect that's having on its financial performance, but the sentiment seems to be that it's not going to be great. So you wonder if, in a way, one competitor's struggling, whether DS Smith and perhaps Smurfit Kappa will sort of be able to pick up the slack a bit and profit where a rival's struggling. But it seems across the sector, market sentiment isn't great just because there seems so many worries that they won't be able to continue to offset the cost pressure, really.
I suppose it's an interesting dynamic between those three as well in the context of something I think you've mentioned before. When we did our FTSE 350 review, it is still quite a fragmented sector in Europe. And obviously, it was only a couple of years ago that Mondi was rumoured to be interesting in DS Smith. I mean, that, you know, it's got bigger things on its plate now, as you say, but that is always something I suppose to watch out for with these companies as well, as with any company at the moment, that potential M&A activity.
Yeah, analysts I spoke to seem to think there might be a few takeovers on the cards as we go forward, but we'll have to see, I suppose.
Yeah, there's some dangers involved with that as well, because a former constituent in the sector, RPC, they came unstuck to a certain degree because of their M&A activities in a short space of time. So, you know, from an investment perspective, that's one thing that our readers have to take on board.
Well, let's move on from the staid world of boxes to the exciting, or at least hitherto exciting, and fast moving world of high growth investment and venture capital. Our cover story this week, written by Alex, is looking at the lessons that one can learn from venture capitalists, from their mindset, perhaps not from their near-term performance, because obviously things have gone, the context has changed somewhat in the last few months for early stage investment. But I think it's fair to say, and this is the thrust of the piece, that, you know, the lessons endure regardless of, you know, the performance of certain companies in the short term and the way the market sentiment has shifted. So, Alex, do you want to sort of talk through what your kind of thoughts were?
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe that is a place to start with. Is the headlines about venture capital at the moment are all focusing on how bad their returns currently are, or put another way, how bad the returns might be if they were forced to disclose the actual valuations of the companies in their portfolios. Which, you know, for listeners who need a catch up, has really been turbocharged by a huge amount of private money. Money for private investment sloshing around in the last few years, which has, you know, racked up the valuations, particularly of technology firms, before they even, you know, see a glimpse of public markets. So that's the story that is obviously dominating VC at the moment. But what I wanted to do with the piece basically is sort of look beyond that and kind of almost take a contrarian view on what's going on in that. In the world of private investing now, and highlight why really over the long term there are some very important lessons which investors can apply from a kind of venture capital investing mindset to their own portfolios and investing in general. So I mean, I won't go into all the lessons, but I mean a couple I think it maybe is worth picking out. I mean, first, maybe most importantly, you know, the most important insight of VC investing is basically the point that innovation is greater than incrementalism. And, you know, we can probably get philosophical about where the line is between those two concepts, because, you know, a business focused on efficiency over a generation will make changes which look like an innovation. But really, I mean, when we talk about innovation, we're focusing on companies which create enormous value and these zeitgeist-like shifts. And that's often at the moment led by technology. And in business, a lot of that value does accrue to a handful of companies that do that innovation best or manage to capture that innovation most successfully. So, you know, if you look back to the last sort of 40 years, you know, you've got IBM when it came to the rise of computing, Microsoft when it adapted that into the world of personal computing, and then perhaps Apple when it came to merging that revolution with smartphone technologies. And those three companies alone, they're three of the five greatest value generating companies in the US market in the last 80 years. And, you know, together with two other companies which might not be so associated with innovation at the moment, General Electric and Exxon Mobil, that cohort of five companies has accounted for about a tenth of all the value generated by more than 25,000 listed US stocks over an 80-year period. So it really does accrue to value really does accrue within, you know, the companies that are focused on, you know, on long-term game-changing technologies and innovations. And that's just in public markets. So what is often happening at a smaller scale is a lot more impactful and dramatic, you know, given that's the realm of new idea generation. And you've got the other point where large bureaucratic corporates as well may not always be the best at fostering innovation, or have certain biases where they want to cling on to, you know, structural markets or the status quo. You know, the second lesson I just very briefly pull out is the limits of forecasting. Of course, I mean, so much of what we write about in the magazine is about the, you know, the value of numbers. And I really don't want to downplay the importance of financial metrics and you know, cash flows and profit and loss accounts and balance sheets, because that really is the bread and butter of how you value a company or try and understand its growth and the marketplace in which it is based. But when you're dealing with breakout technologies, I mean, you're talking about early stage companies, the commercialization stage of an idea, it can often be a bit of a roll of the dice. So, you know, you might have another competitor which just beats you to all the, you know, the juicy contracts and just gets ahead of you. It might be that an idea is before its time. It might be an idea or technology that large companies can replicate successfully in-house. So it's a really high risk trade, really high risk area of investing, but the potential reward is exposure to, you know, the kind of hockey stick graph growth where sales double every year, and you know, you make, you know, the VC investors talk about 10x, 100x, 500x returns, rather than, you know, the single digit incremental growth, just to return to the first point that we often focus on as public markets investors. Those are two of the lessons I think.
And I suppose in terms of how the private investor can access these opportunities, the variety of ways. I mean, you could, in the one classic way, you know, spread your bets quite thinly over a small group of companies, knowing that, you know, nine, frankly, are probably going to fail and one might come off, which, you know, comes with its own challenges and comes with its own requirements in terms of, you know, the disposable cash you need to do that. Yeah. But obviously there are other routes as well.
Yeah. I suppose the most basic one might be an overallocation to technology. That's been a very, very painful trade over the last year, but over the long term, you know, technology companies of the sort of last 20 years have or particularly the last 10 years have done very, very well. I mean, for UK investors, there are a few ways into venture capital or early stage companies which might not have listed yet. One we highlighted in the piece is Molten Ventures. They're an investment trust, but they're also a PLC in the FTSE 250. They're formerly known as Draper Esprit, and they own stakes in around 70 private European fintechs and tech firms. They were an early backer of Trustpilot, Kazoo, and UiPath, all of which debuted in the last year. And I mean, all those stocks have done quite badly since they listed, but you know, they got in long before an IPO was on the cards, so they're able to capitalize on a lot of the, you know, that valuation upside. And then there's the VCT, the Venture Capital Trust route, where, you know, it's important to make a couple of points on this. But the first important thing to note is if you invest in VCTs in the secondary market, you don't get this upfront tax income tax relief that comes with primary issuance or new VCT, basically when new VCTs are launched. And second is that they can be quite illiquid as well. So that's an issue. And then if you want to participate in a VCT launch, you know, there are a few obstacles there. It might need to be that you are advised if you're gonna participate in the launch. You may need to qualify as a sophisticated or a high net worth individual in the first place. And the minimum stakes can be prohibitively expensive for some investors. So yeah, it's all about striking that balance between what you use VCT for. I mean, Mary McDougall's written a huge amount about this in the personal finance section over the last year, because there's obviously been an explosion in VCT listings, you know, in the last year and a half. So yeah, those are a few of the ways you can get in. Not all of them, but a few to highlight.
Yeah, I think we do see, with, as you make that point, with the VCT interest, you know, it used to be that VCT season was the first quarter of the calendar year. Now, a lot of the time, a lot of VCTs are closed already because the demand has been so strong. I mean, there's a few different reasons for that, but one of them certainly is that interest in tapping into these early stage opportunities. I suppose before we move on, we should kind of consider the VC landscape in general. I know we were just chatting about this beforehand, but as you say, you know, there has been a bit of a freeze at the moment, unsurprisingly, given what's happening in markets in general. But I think it's fair to say that that's not going to turn into a big melt. That freeze is going to, you know, unthaw, and things might continue on much as they have done, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the big issues you've got now is you've had these series of fundraisings for early stage company, which has just bid up their valuations to, in some cases, unsustainable levels. So we've now had a correction in technology stocks in the listed markets, which has been about, you know, 50%, call it, and a lot more for some companies. So what do you do if you are an early stage investor or an early stage company and you've seen your valuation bid up considerably in the last few years? To take what's known in the trade as a down round implies either a loss of momentum. It can have knock-on effects for employees, many of whom are, you know, their wealth is entirely bound up in the illiquid holding, illiquid exposure to the shares in the company. So yeah, there is an element of a bit of a freeze coming to that VC market. But yeah, I mean, Andreessen Horowitz, one of the big VC firms, so, you know, one of their partners made the point a couple of years ago that each year there's going to be a series of companies which VC firms, if they are looking to benefit on these huge long-term returns, basically have to get in front of, because they're going to have breakout technologies or ideas which is going to value them at, you know, multi-billion dollar valuations at some point. And you know, those companies aren't going to go away. Those opportunities aren't going to be sought after by private money, but the valuations for now might be bid down a little bit as some of the hot money leaves the sector. So yeah,
I guess the other thing is, you know, no matter what the concerns about, you know, the near term in terms of the economy, in terms of inflation, you know, all these VCs like private equity are sitting on large piles of cash. So really, you know, if anything, the onus to invest them is growing even stronger, given the way that will be eroding nowadays. Speaking of fundraising, let's move on to our third segment, and a familiar name when it comes to tapping investors for cash. Ocado has returned once again, raising another $578 million, rather. Maddie, welcome back to the show. Maddie covers retail for us and, in fact, wrote a sell idea on Ocado just a couple of months back. I mean, as I say, this isn't the first time Ocado has come to investors cap in hand. It does say it will be the last, because it will give it enough money for the next few years, and then it will be making money and producing cash flows to sustain itself, finally. What's the kind of reaction been to this, Maddie? You know, can we believe Ocado when it makes that kind of promise? You know, is this the, you know, one last push, or is this another sign that actually is, you know, very difficult to make money in this space?
Well, hello. It's good to be back on the podcast. I think when it comes to Ocado, jam tomorrow is often the term that's applied to them because they've had this sort of habit in recent years of constantly coming back to equity and debt markets to raise more money to fund the next stage of growth, while at the same time sort of kicking profitability down the road a little bit. So this latest fundraise is, it follows up on a £500 million bond issuance last year. Prior to that, you know, in the previous year, they had raised £1 billion in debt and shares, and they'd also sold off half of their retail business in the UK to M&S. So it's clear that they're really running through cash at quite an astonishing pace. And in the meantime, you know, they've only had 3 full year profits in their entire more than 20 year history. And none of those came in the last 6 years. So I think some investors have started to sort of tire of this pattern, which isn't really helped by Ocado's shifting their business model to be this very CapEx intensive model where they're trying to build warehouses essentially for other grocery partners overseas rather than focusing on what is actually generating cash for them at the moment, which is the UK retail business.
Yeah, that overseas business, you know, there's been a lot of interest and excitement, you know, when they've signed some deals in the past, but it is still making very little in terms of revenue, let alone bottom line as well, isn't it?
Yes. So I think at the moment, it's only about 2% of sales come from that overseas section. And that is predicted to rise to about 16% by analysts by 2027. And they are making progress there because they're constantly building lots of their warehouses. So they've got a pipeline of about 48 of them at the moment that they're building for partners, including Kroger in the US, Casino Group in France, and more. And so there's definitely potential there, but the problem with them is that they're capacity linked, and so they only start making money for Ocado really once they're fully up and running.
I think obviously to most of us, you know, or certainly to if you ask the person in the street, they would say Ocado, obviously the focus is very much still on the online groceries side of things. In terms of public perception, and you know, that is obviously notoriously a very difficult place to make money. I suppose at that point we should move on perhaps to Tesco, which also put out a trading update this week, which by contrast, you know, looks pretty good. Obviously Tesco has a lot more to it than just an online offering, which is to its strength. It was placed to its strengths rather at the moment. And it's still, in fact, growing market share. I mean, I think the management was saying this week they're obviously trying to pass on some costs, but they want to do so in a way that's a little bit less and a little bit later than the rest of the market. I mean, does that seem to be a winning strategy at the moment, positioning themselves between the discounters and the rest of the market?
Yes, I mean, I think when it comes to Tesco, they are in quite a good position just because they are so dominant already. You know, they're part of they're the largest of the big four supermarkets. And so far, they have managed to keep growing their total revenues, even though their like-for-like supermarket sales are down 1.5%. And they did notice that customers are more often choosing to trade down to unbranded goods rather than going for the more expensive sort of brands they might be used to. So they are feeling that cost of living pressure. But at the same time, I think there is some sentiment in the market that they might be better placed to withstand all of the cost pressures and inflation than some of their peers, partly because, you know, when you think about Asda and Morrisons, for example, they are both private equity owned and they have a lot of leverage. So they might not, going forward, be able to invest as much in keeping the prices low. It may be harder for them. And then you look at other supermarkets like Waitrose and M&S and indeed Ocado that are seen very much as slightly more premium, higher end offerings. Whereas Tesco is sort of, as you say, in that middle category. You know, they're not quite the Aldis and the Lidls, which have been growing the market share the fastest. But at the same time, they are a trusted and very large brand with a big presence in the market.
I think it was interesting as well that for Tesco, you know, the Booker side of things, obviously that was an acquisition a few years back, which was quite hotly contested, but, you know, one quarter doesn't make up for that. But they did report some quite interesting, quite notable growth from that catering side, which sort of chimes with what we saw and what we discussed in the podcast the other week with Compass Group as well. Mark, what are your kind of thoughts on, you know, the impact of substitutions and, you know, consumer spending and how retailers and how, you know, food retailers in particular can manage these kind of these changing habits, these forced changes in habits?
I think looking at what statistics we have at this stage, it appears that the explosion that we saw in online shopping with regarding at the outset of the pandemic, it's sustained in other areas better than it has in grocery shopping as well. And it's interesting to note the reasons for this. I mean, it must be linked in some way to the fact that we're seeing, you know, decade record inflation in the last four decades or so. And as Maddie alluded to earlier on as well, this is obviously seeing the growth in the German discounters too. On that point about Ocado as well, the food inflation that we're seeing at the moment probably couldn't come as a worse time for them, really, because their business model isn't predicated on price savings. Whereas, again, Maddie pointed out that Tesco, through their price match policy and other initiatives as well, has managed to keep in the hunt there in terms of value for shoppers. I wrote in Taking Stock a little while about this as well, that Tesco, because of their sheer catchment and market reach, volumes there aren't going to be as volatile because they can reach other parts of the UK that Audi and its ilk cannot as well. So I think the emphasis for consumers is obviously on value now, and it really couldn't have come at a worse time for Ocado, I don't think.
Yeah, and unfortunately it does seem like this might continue for a while longer. I think it was Citigroup yesterday who have revised back their expectations of when food inflation will peak to next spring.
Well, yeah, I think most of the problems that we're seeing in terms of the shortages of fertilizers and other inputs as well, that will be brought to bear really in the winter months of 2023. It'll become obvious then just what a large problem this is.
Yeah. We shall see how that develops, and hopefully it won't be too damaging. But thank you, everyone, for your contributions today. Thank you to Alex, to Mark, to Maddie, and to Gemma. And thank you to you for listening. We will be back next week with another Companies and Markets show. Goodbye.